Welcome to the Style My Mind podcast. On this show, we decipher the secrets, tips, and guidance of fashion and psychology with the world's most inspiring people. Our mission is to unlock the power to become the best version of yourself by turning their wisdom and knowledge into practical advice. One woman's name is currently everywhere, Kamala Harris. To quote our today's esteemed guest, as America's first female president, Harris could radically transform what power looks like by using fashion to express femininity and multiculturalism. So, today we are thrilled to delve into the world of fashion psychology, women, politics, and power. I'm your host, Jennifer Heinen, and I'm excited to introduce our guest, Elizabeth Sagrin. Elizabeth is a senior staff writer at The Fast Company, writing about design with a particular focus on the fashion industry. She was recognized in 2019 Best in Business Awards from the Society for Advancing Business Editing and Writing within the retail category. She is the author of The Rocket Years, How Your 20s Launched the Rest of Your Life. Her work has been published pretty much everywhere, but especially in The Atlantic, The New Republic, Foreign Policy, Foreign Affairs, and The Nation. Welcome, Elizabeth. I'm thrilled to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
So, Elizabeth, I've already spoken. You have been writing pretty much everywhere and you've had massive impact. So can you tell us a bit about your background and where your passion for writing comes from, especially in the fashion industry?
Yeah, my background is rather unusual for a journalist. I actually set out not to become a journalist at all. I wanted to become a professor of ancient Indian literature. So after undergrad, I went and got a PhD in classical Indian love poetry. And I loved it. I spent my 20s, going to India, spending a lot of time kind of understanding ancient cultures. And it was wonderful, but it was unfortunately, there was not a huge market for scholars of third century Indian love poetry. And so over time, the thing that I realized that I loved doing most of all was writing. I like the process of thinking through working through words on a page. And over the years, as a business journalist, that took me into the world of fashion. And I think that the reason that I am so attracted to the world of fashion is, I think, a little bit similar to you. Clothes themselves, are not that important to me. I didn't grow up obsessed with fashion, but what I've always been interested in what clothing reflects about how we think about issues of gender, about how even about things that have to do with kind of what we value, because the entire fashion supply chain is such a huge part of our economy, of the global economy, and kind of the way that we, the labor issues that surround it, sort of reflect a lot about who we are as a people, right? And in the kind and the kinds of humans that we value and don't value, in terms of the labor that they contribute. I mean, the fashion supply chain is, consists of a very, very large female workforce, right? It's something like over 80% of all people who work in the fashion supply chain are women and are usually treated very badly and have very, very low wages. So to me, a garment is never really just a garment. It's something beautiful to be sure, when a beautiful, design has been created, but it also says so much about culture and about the economy and all of these other bigger issues. And that's, to me, the thing that is more interesting.
That's such a fascinating point, right? Because a lot of people always look at fashion from like a cultural perspective, but more like what, like historical cultures, how they have looked like, but looking at it from the current culture and how the culture around economics is such an interesting twist. So thank you so much for bringing that to my attention.
I think it's actually deeply influenced by the work that I did. So, when I was working on my PhD, I spent a lot of time in India, And I also, you know, I grew up all over the world. I actually grew up in Paris and then in Jakarta because of my father's job. He worked in an airline. And so I think I really saw fashion, you know, as it played out across all of these countries, right? Like you go to a place like Paris, which is a fashion capital, you see so much creativity, you see runway shows, you see women dressed so beautifully as they go down the streets. But then you go to Indonesia and India and you see the factories where these products are made. And then you realize that there's, you know, there's so much inequity in order to create, you know, these beautiful garments. So anyway, that's just a bit more context.
No, absolutely. That's fantastic. Thank you for giving us a bit more insights on where you're coming from and your history, which is important. So one of the reasons why I'm super excited to talk with you about is your latest article around Kamala Harris's pantsuit culture. And you explore in that the symbolism of power suits. So it's very, very interesting, especially from a fashion psychology perspective. Can you elaborate maybe on how political leaders use fashion as a tool for influence?
So I've been really interested in suits as a way for women to project power. So I've been writing about this for about 10 years now. And I think it's really interesting because, you know, about 10 years ago, there were a bunch of new suiting companies that sort of hit the market. There was this, you know, the direct-to-consumer movement produced a bunch of companies, including Argent here in the US, another one called M.M. Lafleur. All of these brands that were creating suits for women who were, you know, in the workplace, right? They were creating suits for women in all of these different sort of high-powered professions. And it was interesting because this was a period when the workplace was becoming more and more casual. And so, you know, a lot of companies that were previously very focused on a formal dress code began to sort of abandon their dress codes. And, you know, first it started with casual Fridays, and then eventually many of these companies dropped the dress code altogether. In the tech industry, this was very common. And then now, you know, you go to a consulting company, you go to some law firms, and many of them have also sort of abandoned the dress code. And yet, women still felt like it was really important for them to show up in these very professional outfits. And to me, that really reflected that image was still extremely important for women in a way that it stopped being that important for men in terms of how they showed up to work. And that was a really interesting point, you know, that for me to sort of work through. And so I, you know, as somebody who has a background in sort of history and literature, I wanted to like look back at the history of the suit. And I think it's really interesting. It's always been this symbol of male power and respectability. So, I mean, various scholars who have looked into this argue that actually the suit sort of came out of the military garments, right? In the 1700s and sort of 1800s, you know, the suit was sort of like a step away from the military garments, very dark colors, very prim, very well pressed. Over time, you know, as society, you know, had these huge, you know, originally when the suit emerged, you know, there were all of these social stratifications. There was the aristocracy, and then there was sort of the peasant class. But in these years, there was a growing middle class of families and men who were going out into the workplace and trying to establish themselves. And the suit was the way in which they began to project that they had status, right? And they weren't necessarily the aristocracy, but they were no longer part of the peasant class. They looked professional. And so the suit has become this global symbol that men have used as kind of an armor to project their value to the world. And I think what's really interesting is that we now live in this world where men no longer feel like they need to do that anymore. And instead, it's women who are sort of taking on this garment that has historically been associated with male power. And they're sort of wearing that at a time when many men don't wear suits anymore. Women are still choosing to wear these suits. So that's kind of where this kind of began to be interesting to me. And then as I was looking at some of these suiting brands, I began to notice that women in the United States who were in office and in political office and who were vying for political power began to use the suit in all kinds of interesting ways. And so that's kind of where the reporting about women in politics began to emerge for me.
Yeah, that's fantastic. How do you think, especially with Kamala Harris being now the front runner in the political race, her fashion choices, not only now, but also in the past, have impacted her public perception of her leadership?
Well, I think it's interesting because I think that there's a little bit of history here in for women in politics that's important to contextualize. So, you know, even though like in the 1980s, there was this kind of first round of women wearing suits, like there was the power suit, right? So women have had access to a suit in the workplace for quite a long time. But in politics, there was a lot of pressure for women not to wear suits, because it's very strange to me, because this was happening all over the US in the 80s, like women who were in banking and all of these different careers were wearing these suits with these huge shoulder pads and everything. But there was something about that that seemed very threatening to male politicians. Women were still in a small minority in positions of power in the government, but there were actually sort of rules, like sort of, there were unspoken rules, but women had to wear a skirt if they were going to show up on the floor of Congress. And so over the sort of the 80s and all the way into like the early 90s, women who wore suits were frowned upon, you know, women in politics who wore suits were frowned upon. But then in about 1993, three women in the US Congress showed up in suits, like on a regular basis. And this provoked a change, allowing women to start wearing, the rules were written down for the first time. And it said that women could wear a coordinated pantsuit. So this was like, women were in politics were sort of prevented from being able to wear a suit for a long time. So I think in the 90s, there was this movement because suddenly women had this ability to dress in a suit. Many of them started to do this. And I think this was really, really important because, you know, until that point, it was very obvious when a woman and a man in politics were standing next to each other because the woman had to wear something different from the man. It was like emphasizing her gender. And in all of this time, you know, voters are just very biased, right? Even we saw this with Hillary Clinton. Even people who think on, you know, on the surface that they're not biased, that they're very feminist, that they would vote for a woman. You know, there's all of this data that shows that actually we're used to seeing men in power. And when we see a woman in power, we have all of these sort of subconscious biases, right? And so by emphasizing that a woman looks different than a man, it was sort of re-triggering all of these subconscious biases. And so it was really important, I think, in the 90s that this change happened and that women were able to wear suits for the first time. And I think the one figure who is most interesting to me in all of this is Hillary Clinton, because in the 90s, if you recall, she was still sort of supporting her husband, Bill Clinton, who was president. And in those years, she was, you know, still wearing very feminine kind of outfits that were sort of like expected at the time of women in the political arena. But as she began entering positions of power herself, she wore very classic sort of male coded suits. So when you see her in the sort of late 90s and early 2000s, she's wearing a very masculine, dark colored suit. And so I think that was really, she was sort of laying the foundation as the woman who was coming closest to the presidency, right, as in her own run. She was kind of showing the world kind of what she wanted to project. And what she wanted was for people to no longer think about her in terms of her gender. And they wanted just, she just wanted to be treated as equal to her male counterpart. And so if you see her like on a debate stage wearing something that's very, very similar to her opponent, then you're no longer having all these conversations about like, oh, what is she wearing? Like, what designer is she wearing? Like, what do those colors mean? All of that kind of thing. She was trying to put all of that to rest. But then I think as she, you know, she was a senator for a while, then she was Secretary of State. Over time, as it became more and more common to see her in positions of power, and then as other women began rising up through the political ranks, we saw Hillary Clinton begin to change her wardrobe a little bit. And she still wore suits, but suddenly she started wearing suits that had different colors. And so actually, like, if you go and you look this up, there's like, she has almost every single color of the rainbow, right? In terms of suits. She would wear, sometimes she would wear suits that had a bit more texture, like Chanel kind of, you know, style suits. Other times she would wear colors that were quite dramatically different from her opponent. When she was a Secretary of State, and there are pictures of her next to Obama, like Obama's always in a dark suit, and she was wearing like a teal colored suit, or you know, a light tan colored suit, or whatever, right? And so again, I think this was an important move, because I think what she was trying to show the world at that point, like a decade later, a decade into her own political rise, was that it is possible for you to be treated as equal to a man, but also to allow the fact that you're a woman not to be seen as something that you want to sort of, you know, push under the rug or ignore completely. You can sort of represent yourself as a woman, right? Just like, you know, I think that was kind of what she was trying to say. It's that, you know, like I have the authority and the power to be here in this position, but I'm also trying to signal that I'm a little bit different as well, that I'm a woman and that I have a different perspective on some of these issues. And so anyway, that was kind of what she was doing under, during her presidential run. So I think that that was kind of the model that she laid out as far as how we think about how a woman running for president, what she should wear. And so that's like kind of the most recent example that we have of a female candidate running for president. And that is the world into which Kamala Harris, you know, walks into, right? So now Kamala Harris is, is campaigning for the presidency. And we're seeing her doing something very similar to Hillary Clinton. She is still choosing to wear a suit. That's the main thing that we see her wearing. But she's often wearing a color that is brighter or different than her male opponent. And occasionally we see some other things too. Like sometimes underneath her shirt, she's not just wearing an Oxford button-down shirt, but she's wearing kind of a more feminine blouse. We always see her wearing pearl jewelry. So it's this kind of Hillary Clinton-esque approach, which is that she's trying to not make the conversation about what she's wearing, because she's ultimately just wearing a suit, which is similar to what her opponent is wearing. But she's not trying to make the fact that she's a woman something that we're ignoring. She's willing to sort of reflect the fact that she is, you know, she is an extraordinary candidate, because she's the first, you know, she would be the first female president. She's not shying away from that either. And so I think this is where we are right now as far as like female politicians and how they're dressing.
It's so interesting, especially with you bringing in the historical significance of the pantsuit and women taking kind of a very authoritarian look and take the authority and take it in their own hands and taking that power and just flipping the script just because it's encoded somehow differently. Why should we go with that flow? And rise to the occasion of fighting for equality on a very different level, in a very subtle manner, and then in a very impactful manner. So thank you so much for pointing that out and making that so clear. It's going to be super beneficial for every woman listening to this podcast. It's also interesting that you spoke to the differences between male and female, because for the male opponents, it was always very clear, dark suit. You see that even in other professions, not only in the political area, but Kamala Harris coming from lawyers all wear very specific coded outfits, and then she's now moving, I feel like moving even more into a more colorful and cheerful, and it shows almost a bit more of her personality, but still in a very professional manner.
I think that, you know, I think it's interesting because I also think that Obama had, as the first Black president, was also struggling with this in some way, right? Where, you know, it's true. The Black suit, as you're saying, continues to be kind of this symbol of professionalism and authority. And so there was one time when Obama showed up in a tan suit to deal with like a very important conversation about terrorism. And what was interesting is that many Republicans, many of his opponents, called him out for looking unpresidential just because his suit was not dark. And so it was really, it's really interesting because I think this is something that a lot of minorities are struggling with. It's not just the fact that Kamala Harris is a woman or that Hillary Clinton was a woman. I think people of color and men of color have to abide by these standards, right? But what I think is really interesting is that men who have privilege, so white men, they are now feeling more and more free to kind of go more casual. So even in like the law, right? You know, when I talk to law firms, increasingly they're trying to sort of create more relaxed dress codes because they think it's going to attract more workers if, you know, if they don't have to show up in a suit every day. And it generally is white men who are willing to sort of go along with that and wear, you know, khakis or sometimes like, you know, even show up in even more like hoodies, you know, on certain days. And women and, you know, men of color are choosing not to do that because it takes a certain amount of privilege to be able to not use this symbol of professionalism to project power.
That's mind blowing to consider, right? It's not just the gender bias, but it's the general privilege of being free to wear whatever you want, kind of. And we're still
totally, yeah,
and having to be very specific. I find it quite crazy because I'm sitting in London, and here in London, I always knew London as this posh, always dandy, a lot of suits, just in general, because people like to dress up and feel like empowered, and you walk differently when you wear a very structured blazer. So it's very fascinating, but people get very lax here. But also when I work with people and work with women, they all refer quicker to a suit as well. Now that you've spoke about it, it's blatantly clear and totally aware now that we kind of have to still fight so much more and in a different way, fighting for something completely different. And a power suit, I love the word power suit so much because it empowers no matter who wears it. So yeah, I kind of hope personally in the future that the suit can turn into a more gender fluid, neutral space so that it doesn't have to have this encoding of male or female anymore. But that's just a personal opinion and hope, I guess.
Well, yeah, and I guess, you know, the kind of the argument that I was making in the story is that I feel like, you know, so Hillary Clinton was already sort of pushing, was changing the dynamics about what people could wear because, you know, she was taking very, very much like all of the symbolism of male power, very sort of kind of broad-shouldered, dark suit. That's what she wore at the beginning. And when she felt like she had more power and when her situation and her position was more stable, that's when she began to push the boundaries, right? And began to reflect her personality, the colors that she liked, the texture, her whole self. Like she was able to sort of bring more of herself into what she was wearing instead of just kind of pretending to be you know, a male politician through what she was wearing. She could be, you know, a woman politician. It was like a new concept, right? But my hope is that with Kamala Harris, you know, if you know, if she does become president. And once again, she's in a position where her power is secure, where she's not campaigning anymore, where she's just kind of, you know, taking on this role, that over time, she will be able to go even maybe beyond the suit, because she won't need to sort of use this male symbol to express power anymore, because we'll all recognize that it's possible for a woman to be governing and for a woman to be in power. And so in my story, I was saying that, you know, it would be so interesting if she could, move away from the suit and actually maybe even reflect aspects of her culture. She's half South Indian, which is actually like where my ancestry is as well. And her father was Jamaican, right? And so, you know, there, it's so interesting. She doesn't actually try to reflect those aspects of her personality or her background when she goes, even when she's out. And that makes a lot of sense, right? Because we've never had a South Asian or a person from the Caribbean in a position of power. And I think subliminally, a lot of voters might hold that against her, right? Even if they're not explicitly, biased, right? Like there are these implicit, biases, right, under the surface. And so I think it makes sense that she's not doing that right now. But maybe when her power was more secure, like if she wanted to, she could reflect those aspects of her culture. And I don't know how that would manifest. I mean, I would love to see her wearing a sari one day, in the Oval Office or something like that. But I mean, I don't want to sort of project that onto her, because that might not be something that she authentically, relates to. But I know that she's very proud of her mother, who is from South Asia. And I think there are lots of pictures of her mother wearing a sari. I'm sure that there are ways in which she would love to, reflect those cultures in some way. I mean, it could be wearing, a suit that was made from material from, like textiles from the Caribbean or South Asia. But also like, imagine if she just went beyond the suit altogether and just started wearing dresses or wearing pieces that were more feminine, right? I think it's important, because right now she's in a position where she's still asking us for our vote, right? She still hasn't been elected. But if she were to be in a position of power, the dynamics would change. And not only would her position be secure, she could be changing the way that we think of power. And so if she was able to show up, looking, with more femininity, with more multiculturalism, that could change, America's perception of what power can look like, and sort of pave the way for other people who are women and who are from other cultures to show up, and and we'll just think of that as normal, right? It's kind of changing. She can use clothing to sort of help us reimagine what power can look like, and it can look beyond, the white male, basically.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be absolutely fantastic if we redefine power by just being authentically, truly who we are and wear what we actually want to personally express? Wouldn't that be an absolute dream come true? Also, for the younger people out there who are listening, it's so tough to navigate this new world where you kind of have to figure out what do you wear to work. Because then you have, of mm-hmm. course, casual dress codes, but there is still, a lot of people say like there are no dress codes, but that's not true. There are so many dress codes that are underlying or partially biased there. And I've seen many people who are trying to prep themselves for an interview. They do wear a suit on the interview, at least, or the suit jacket with a blouse. It doesn't matter. So it would be so fabulous to see her balancing this personal expression and professional presence.
I agree. I think that would be, I think that the ultimate power is being able to just show up entirely as you are. And unfortunately, we're not there yet. And people still get judged, I think, if they don't look like what we expect power to look like. But I do think it's interesting, this question of young people, because when I talk to brands that are trying to create outfits for the workplace, you know, I think it's a very delicate balance because, you know, so some people are going for an interview and they might be going to a tech firm. And if they look too formal, like if they're wearing a suit that looks too prim and, you know, and too formal, you know, that could be used against them too, right? It looks like they don't fit into the company culture if they're like at a tech firm or if they're in a creative industry. But if they show up in like jeans and a t-shirt and they're also very young, that looks like maybe they don't have the professionalism. So it's actually in some ways can be quite hard. It can be even harder sometimes to try and figure out, like in the old days, we knew that the suit was the thing that we had to do, right? And so it almost made it easier. You just had to get like, you know, a nice suit and then there you go. And now you have to think about what happens if you're not, if you're too formal and then how that could work against you.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I had this discussion with in a prior podcast episode, actually. We were talking about like professional presence and especially in your early stages of your career. And I think that it would be actually fantastic to put a dress code when you're getting invited to an interview. You should put that in. You should put in, you know, you can show up in jeans or, you know, even a one-liner. This is what we wear. You can wear the same, you know, because the thing is, you're already nervous enough to go to an interview, to a job that you really want.
And I think it's so hard if you don't get a job because you were overdressed, right? Because you were trying really hard to like do what you thought was right. And then, you know, you were overdressed and then they held it against you because it made it look like you didn't get the culture. So I think that's like very cruel, I think. But that's, I mean, that happens, right? It's not like they're like, oh, you wore a suit, we're not going to hire you. It's more like, oh, you know, maybe she doesn't understand, like maybe she's not going to fit in here, right? Because she's not wearing like what we wear kind of thing.
Yeah. I have now a tough question for you. Do you have any advice for not only leaders, but also for younger people who are starting out, who are maybe thought leaders, particularly women, on navigating traditional dress codes while staying true to their identity?
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time thinking about this because of kind of thinking about Hillary Clinton and these women in power. And I think that what they're doing is kind of the right balance. And I think it should be a good place for us, for those of us who are trying to figure this out. It's a good place to start. I think that, you know, especially for women, like the suit is actually a very useful garment. Because I think it still does carry a lot of symbolism. I think when you see somebody in a suit, you immediately like project certain qualities onto them, like professionalism, power, you know, authority, all of the respectability. And so I think that having a good suit that fits well and that you feel comfortable in is important. I would also say that especially if you're a woman, having it not be too tight fitting, sort of, you know, sort of having it a little looser. There are suits that are sort of cut this way where it's not like you're in a necessarily oversized blazer, although this was kind of a trend recently. I just mean that like there are suits that are also very, very sort of tight fitting and sort of a little bit sexy. I don't think that that's where we want to go either, but a suit is a very useful garment, I think. But I think that what's really interesting is that now with all of these new suiting companies, they come in so many different colors and shades. And so I think that kind of starting with the suit, but then using other cues to sort of make it a little bit more like yourself. So like picking a color that you like underneath the suit, wearing something that, you know, you feel comfortable in, or that it, you know, reflects what you want, whether that is like, kind of like a nice pussy bow, silk blouse, that's like much more feminine. Kamala Harris does this sometimes, or, you know, like I've gone to, you know, events where like, I'm just kind of wearing a tank top underneath like a blazer. And to me, it's like, that's a right balance of kind of casual and a little bit more formal. And then kind of using the other things that you're wearing, like accessories and so on, to reflect, parts of yourself. So in my case, like if I'm going to an event where it's kind of a little unclear what I should be wearing, I tend to go for like a blazer. And so like I was at an event, I was speaking at a conference recently. And so what I wore like, like dark kind of leggings, but they weren't too tight fitting. They were like a little bit looser. They were these leather leggings and a tank top. And then I wore like a pink wool blazer on top that was a little bit oversized. And to me, I feel like that is like, in my world, that's like a very, it's something that you can wear that allows you to not look like you're overdressed and not look like you're underdressed. So I always feel like that is like kind of what I have when I am not sure what the vibe is going to be. Like if you're going to be like in this particular event, there were tons of people who were just wearing suits, right? And I didn't know whether that was going to be the case. So it felt like with a blazer, I felt like I fit in just fine. But what I have been trying to do, though, is that when I'm in a position where I have some authority, where I know what the vibe is going to be, and I feel like I can sort of reflect myself a little bit better, I tend to wear like a dress. And for me, I love Mara Hoffman. She's this amazing sustainable designer who unfortunately has recently closed her business. But, there are a couple of Mara Hoffman dresses that I feel very comfortable in. They have very dramatic sleeves. Sometimes they have a lot of color. And those are outfits that I feel very much myself in. I feel like I'm reflecting myself. And so when I do feel like I'm in a position where I don't have to worry about my status, or like I just feel very confident in the position that I'm in, then I show up in one of those, because I just feel like I'm being my most authentic self.
That's amazing. That's good advice. And also, I want to add to that, because that's what I actually do a lot as well. I love to wear suits. I just feel super confident, and I feel like they do represent how I want to be presented in the professional world. And I also, to be fair, I don't care if I'm seen too overdressed or whatever. It might be the privilege speaking. It's actually a good reflection point on my end also, that I have the freedom to wear whatever I want, or at least that I make that space for me. And if someone says something, I don't care. But it's not impacting my career progression. So that's a good thing about it. But I feel like suits are super versatile, right? So when you are wearing that, and then if you would have noticed that you would have been maybe too overdressed, you can always, take the blazer off and, hold it or something, and you can adapt quite easily to a new outfit. So that's fantastic. Thank you so much.
There's just a lot of different suits on the market now. Like over the last 10 years, and this is, I was telling you about this at the beginning, but like there have been a huge number of suiting companies for women over the last 10 years. And so you can find something that really suits yourself, right? Where it's like, do you prefer like an oversized blazer, a slightly more fitted blazer? Do you prefer one with color, or do you prefer a darker? Like you can really find something that suits yourself. And then also there's a lot of easier sort of like wrinkle-free technology now. So it is a very comfortable and easy garment where you can show up for a lot of different things and feel like you're wearing the right thing. And I think that that is the benefit of the suit.
That I agree. Although, you can have very quickly also, as we spoke to prior, like misstep significantly in certain settings. And I'm always like, I love linen, especially in the summer. But the problem is it wrinkles so much. I understand linen has this elegant wrinkling. It's always what my grandmother said. but still, when you are in a very corporate environment, you don't necessarily want to have any wrinkles showing. It actually leads me to the next question. Can you, thinking about like your research in that area, are there any instances where fashion missteps significantly impacted a political career, or at least given it massive media coverage? As an example, the tan suit, which I think wasn't even a misstep. It was just him stepping outside of the normal box. Mm-hmm. And it suited him so well, too. I mean, to be fair. So I don't know.
I think that actually, for women, I think it's really, really hard. I think that women in politics for a long time, actually, everything that a woman wore was just talked about so much. And I think that that's kind of why we have all settled on a suit and maybe allowing a little bit of color in a suit. But even today, I mean, you know, like for a long time, everything that Hillary Clinton wore, you know, from the time that she was just supporting her husband on his campaigns, like everything that she wore would be dissected, right? And people would talk about it for hours, you know, in the media. And there was, everybody had an opinion and she could never get it right. You know, like some people would say, like when she was wearing kind of more feminine outfits, people would criticize that. They would say she was not wearing the right designer or so on and so forth. You know, when Obama was in power, Michelle Obama's outfits were constantly being talked about. And in fact, she used the fact that people were talking about her outfits and were spending so much time talking about her outfits to be very strategic about what she wore. So she would always pick designers of color, knowing, like, she sort of like used the fact that people would talk about her a lot to try and just steer the conversation into something that she was, you know, thought was valuable. So I do think that even today, there are tons of like missteps that can happen. I think that when, you know, like recently there was this article in the New York Times about Usha Vance's outfit. So she's J.D. Vance, the Republican vice presidential nominee's wife. And, you know, she does not wear suits. She wears a dress. And I think in general, people talk about that as like kind of a positive thing that she wears these very elegant dresses. But she also chooses not to wear a lot of makeup. And a lot of Republican women wear like a ton of makeup and their hair is like perfectly done and they have a lot of makeup on and it's like these sort of hyper feminine looks. And so I'm not saying that necessarily like Usha Vance's outfits have been a faux pas, but it's like we can't just focus on what she's saying. Like the fact that she's wearing a dress, like we're reading so much into this. We're like asking like, okay, why is she wearing a dress rather than wearing a suit? Like, what does that mean about her and about, you know, what she thinks of a woman in a position of power, like all of these kinds of things. And also the fact that she wasn't wearing makeup, I think that was very deliberate on her part, but people are just talking about it a lot. And so I don't know that it's necessarily a faux pas, but I do think that people think that it is okay to spend a lot of time talking about what a woman is wearing, right? And so I totally understand why there is this norm now about what is acceptable for a woman in politics to wear. And that is a suit and maybe with a little bit of color. That's it. And the reason for that is because as when you do that, then people stop talking about what you're wearing because it's just so normative now. It's just the norm. And I really think that, you know, that's kind of what you were saying about like you choosing to wear a suit, like this, that's what I do when I'm not sure what to wear. It's because it's a way to shut off conversation. And I think that, yeah, like if you're anxious about that, if you're anxious about the faux pas, like that's the thing to do, because I think people are still very unkind and will still spend a lot of time dissecting your outfit if you're not wearing what's like totally normative. Unfortunately, that's the world we live in. And that's why I'm hoping that Kamala Harris will help us change that, but we're not there yet.
Yeah, unfortunately. But that's also good advice for everyone listening here. You know, rethink your wardrobe. What's your safe pieces that you can wear? What are pieces that you feel like, mm-hmm. even if people talk about you or what you wear, that you know, you kind of feel shielded and guarded off with what you wear because you feel the most comfortable and most yourself in it. So that's really good advice because I get it. Like it's so fascinating to talk with you about this because you don't want, as a politician who are advocating for so many important human topics, you don't want to divert the conversation away from the important things and then go onto the shallow, oh, what did she wear today? Or what did he wear today? It should be so much more than that. And that's kind of where I'm coming back in and always rehashing that people should feel free enough to express who they are and what their values are and what they stand for with what they are wearing. But yeah, it, it's a big public perception game at the moment that they are very much having to be very conscious of what they're wearing. So yeah, thank you so much for sharing all of that. Speaking of, you already touched upon what you're hoping that Kamala Harris is able to flip the script, so to speak, and change professional wardrobe pretty much entirely. What trends do you currently see emerging in the intersection of fashion and political leadership?
Yeah, I think that we're still seeing a lot of color. But I do think that, especially for like women in positions of power, like, you know, they're opting for more color. I think it was really cool. Like for a little while, we saw like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's like another kind of powerhouse young politician. She, you know, she would show up in like bright pink suits sometimes, right? Like, so really, you know, sticking with the script as far as like wearing a suit, but like really going bold with the colors. Like, I thought that was really great. But the other thing that's really interesting, a lot of them are choosing to project power with jewelry. So, Kamala Harris, we see her wearing a lot of, she always generally wears a pearl necklace. Sometimes she wears big pearl earrings. Again, that's like another way of kind of, projecting a little bit of femininity. I think that that's great. One interesting thing though, is that, you know, Kamala Harris's running mate, Tim Walz, who she just picked, he often shows up for political events not wearing a suit. He just wears like a t-shirt or like a very casual like workman's jacket. John Fetterman, another you know, politician here, is very famous for wearing very, very casual outfits, like even like hoodies into Congress, right? I mean, this is a place where women were not allowed to wear pants like in the 90s, right? And they had to wear very proper dresses. Like, this is how formal this place is. And then like John Fetterman is showing up in a hoodie, right? So I think that's another kind of trend that we're seeing, that the casualization that we're seeing in the workplace, that's more broadly at work in our culture, is beginning to happen in politics, which is making women's more formal outfits like stand out even more, right? So I think that that's really interesting. When Tim Walz goes around, you know, he's like wearing a t-shirt or jeans, you know, to various events, and Kamala Harris is never wearing those things. I think it just kind of throws into relief exactly how different it is and how much privilege you have as a white man that you no longer feel compelled to wear formal clothing.
That's a really good point. Yeah, it's true. It's a privilege again here. But I also want to throw something in here as well. I just got reminded of our latest episode with Ellen Weiss. We discussed what impact clothing can have. And he spoke to the fact that it's also kind of a matter of respect on what you wear. Mm-hmm. And if we look at the videos from the latest rally where they showed up together, he was wearing a black suit, white shirt. So he showed up showing respect with what he wore towards Kamala Harris because they were both wearing a suit. So I think that was a very nice, harmonious kind of visual to see that there is this respect and cherishment of each other, while sticking with the stigma of what a political leader needs to represent and how they have to look like.
They looked well paired, like on that stage. It sort of like made them look very, yeah, really balanced in that way. I wonder if their teams spent some time talking through that. But yeah, I thought that was interesting too.
I agree. That would be interesting to talk with their stylists or whoever is putting their outfits together, if they're doing it themselves anyway, probably. But or if they have talked quickly in the morning, you know, what are you going to wear today? I could talk with you all day. It's absolutely fantastic to discuss this. But I also know that time is limited. So I want to ask you now, what final thoughts do you have on the role of fashion in shaping perceptions of power and leadership, and especially in context of how Kamala Harris can approach to pave the new way of fashion for future leaders?
Yeah, I think that she should, you know, she should use, if she is elected, and I hope she is, that she should use that power to think about kind of paving the way for other people. And that I think that I hope that her team, her stylists, like that everybody is thinking about how clothing can help do that. And by that, I just mean normalizing, you know, having like different people of different cultures, like in that position of power. Like if you start seeing somebody who looks South Asian, right? Like who isn't trying to sort of like hide the fact that she's South Asian, but like lean into the fact that she's South Asian in the White House, like that just opens up a world for so many other, you know, young people in America who may not have, you know, who may be immigrants, who may not, you know, who may not have sort of like white Anglo-Saxon heritage, to think like, wow, like maybe one day that could be me. Or even just like kind of like projecting like femininity, right? You know, just normalizing seeing a woman who is like very feminine, right? Like in a position of power, suddenly, you know, little boys, little girls who are growing up in this country are like, well, that's just our president. Like at some point your eyes adjust to what you're seeing. And suddenly you're like, well, she's just a woman. She looks like, you know, like a lot of other women I know. And if she's in a position of power, then maybe I can be too. I think that a lot of people sort of downplay clothing and fashion, but I think that it's very powerful and it has a lot of like an ability to sort of change underlying perceptions. And so I think she should use that to help, you know, the world basically, you know, to change the way that we think of what power can look like.
Yeah, not only that, and also what she's already doing, instilling a lot of hope and hope for young people to be able to get to that position if that's what they want. So yeah, I can agree only with wholeheartedly. What are your key messages and key advice that you hope that our listeners take away from this discussion about fashion and leadership?
I think analyzing Kamala Harris and Hillary Clinton has showed me that there are times when it's valuable to understand what the norm is and just, you know, wear what is normative, because then people will not be talking about what you were wearing and will actually think about, you know, what you were doing or kind of what you have to offer. But when you are secure in your position of power, that's an opportunity for you to reflect more fully who you are. And so I think that's a good way to think about, you know, what to wear in the morning.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Elizabeth, for sharing your insights and your experiences with us. Absolutely valuable here, and so much meat here to give to other people. So now we do have a closing tradition in this podcast that every episode we challenge our listeners, which facilitates growth, intentionality, and awareness. Can you introduce our listeners to your Style My Mind challenge? What action or mindset would you like them to embrace empowerment at their workplace?
So, you know, I've been thinking about this for a long time, just this idea of how, you know, like I've been a fashion journalist for a long time. I get invited to speak at lots of different events for my expertise and my, you know, my authority, right? And so that I think gives me some flexibility with what I'm wearing. And I think one thing that we didn't talk about, but is super relevant, is that when I want to show up as most myself, I just will wear like quite a bright colored dress, maybe with puffed sleeves, like kind of sort of like a little bit dramatic, but that really reflects me. And I think that there's a lot of pressure to wear something new every time you're doing that, or you're doing a presentation or all of that. There's still this kind of social pressure to do that. And that's really obviously terrible for the environment. Like we shouldn't feel like we need to constantly be changing what we wear. And so what I've been doing and the challenge that I've been giving to myself is to like have a dress that I really, really love, and then just wear it repeatedly. So, you know, as much as I can, even though I know I will be photographed and I know that, you know, people will see that I'm doing this, like I just wear this dress that I love to lots and lots of events. And I think that that's important because it's, you know, number one, it reflects my identity. It's a dress that I really, really like, but also it's just kind of sending the message that you don't have to, you can be a, you know, you can be an outfit repeater, right? Like there's nothing, there's no shame in that. In fact, that there should be some pride in that. So anyway, that's what I think.
That's a fantastic challenge. Thank you so much. So listeners, you have heard the challenge for this episode. Make sure you show your results if you feel comfortable with on all the social medias with hashtag StyleMyMindChallenge and share your results. And also feel free to share a bit of reflection on how it makes you feel and how that has some effect on you. So yeah, fantastic. Thank you so much. Where can our listeners find you and your work, as well as learn more about what you do?
So I write for a magazine called Fast Company. And so you can find all my work at fastcompany.com. And if you look up Elizabeth Segrin, you can find me on Instagram at Liz Segrin. And I'm also very active on LinkedIn. And so you can easily find me by looking up Elizabeth Segrin.
Fantastic. I will put all of those links also into the info box. I will also link in the latest article that you wrote about Kamala Harris, so everyone can read what triggered this conversation. Thank you again, Elizabeth, for joining us today. And to our listeners, if you enjoyed this episode, please like, subscribe, and share. Do all of those beautiful things. Follow us on our social media channels and visit our website for more insightful content. Always keep your head held high, embrace your journey to empowerment, and be open to styling your mind. Thank you so much.